together and make a difference. And I hope if you're listening, don't miss this moment. You have to rise up. If you stand down, you are with the oppressors. You really have to stand up for what you believe in.
Join this listener. Go to give2wbai.org and become a member of WBAI. And thank you.
Stop the music. Okay, the Orange Man is our new president. But are you going to spend inauguration night home alone and sad? No. Come to WBAI's Karaoke at the Commons. Sing a song of protest. Eve of Destruction might be appropriate. Sing a song of joy. Get down with Motown with me, Earth Mom, and my very special guest co-host, Randy Credico. And who knows, he may be bringing Bernie with him.
Join us for Karaoke at the Commons, a mini fundraiser for WBAI, on Friday, January 20th at 7 p.m.
Sing your heart out for WBAI.
Listen up, sweetheart. If you board that plane without making a donation to WBAI, one of these days you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. WBAI is the only station with the guts and determination to seriously challenge this nightmare Trump. The rest of the media are cowards. It's the voice of the poor, oppressed, downtrodden, and the imprisoned. You know, Rick, this fella Trump, here's bad news. He's worse than Major Strasser. Act occasionally. Why don't you make a donation? I already did at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Louie, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Listen to my heart speak.
Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
I'll wait for you.
I'll wait for you. Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
Listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis with my studio companions, hosts and co-hosts,
Paulette Spencer
and
Matt Mazza.
Yes, and we are here with you this very strange time continuum, space-time continuum. I think some of us might have woke up and said, how did I get here? How did this happen? What world am I living in? But yes, we are living in the world of 2017 when we're saying what, Paulette, to whom?
Well,
goodbye.
You're getting
and hello.
You say goodbye and I say hello, to quote the Beatles.
Right, and when you say hello, I say goodbye.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, we're talking about our political scene. The end of the age of Obama.
Yeah.
And the beginning of the age of Trump.
Yeah.
Talk about being between a rock.
Between Barack and a hard place.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly.
There you go. So wow. It's a weird situation. So do you have any thoughts about all this, Paulette?
Mm. Well, the Chinese always say, may you live in interesting times. And I guess that's what we're about to experience. I mean, it has been interesting all along.
I was just getting ready to say, I don't know that we have lived anything else.
You're right. You're right.
It's been an interesting world to grow up in and to be in.
Yeah.
And it seems to be getting consistently strangled from the perspective of the corporate elite. But as that's happening, more and more people are waking up to this reality, so that really does have an impact.
Yeah, I think that part of what fuels my opinions normally have to do with how policies affect people in other countries. I think that that's something that sort of haunts me, and it's certainly something that's going to be affecting us here in terms of domestic policy, but in terms of foreign policy, I don't really know what it's like to be sitting in another country on the other side of the planet, having experienced the last 8 years or the last 20 or 25 years of dastardly things happening, and now sort of having to buckle down and see what the next 8 years or 4 years are going to bring. So I think that it's a serious thing, and I was speaking to a bus driver coming over, and we were talking about this, and he was saying that he was frightened about what was going to happen, and that in terms of, you know, promises for jobs and sort of booting people out of jobs, he said, you know, the people that Trump would want to bring into these jobs would never, ever accept the kind of pay that the people who are in those jobs now do accept.
And they probably wouldn't be paid. They probably would be paid more.
Yeah, or not.
Or not.
And if not, then it's going to get very interesting.
Well, I think it's all going to be very interesting. I think the assumption, because of the ranting and ravings of Trump and his trumpets, as we've been calling them.
Trumpets.
Yeah. You know, all of his appointees, they're pretty much like trumpets of his same. So they're like a retro group from the 50s singing their retro songs of oppression. So that's why I call them Trump and the Trumpets. But I think that there's going to be more revelation, that as much as they're making it seem that it's the Arabs and the blacks that are the problem, eventually people across the country are going to begin, if they haven't already, to realize that all of these changes are going to impact them greatly.
Absolutely.
And so what's happening is that Trump and his bizarre crew, I don't know what to say about the people he's appointed, because they're not politicians, they're not people who serve the public, they're people who serve private interests, pretty specifically. So I believe that I'm not really afraid, because I think what's going to happen is these Republicans, who are the overwhelming number of Republicans who were swept into office because of Trump, are going to have to answer to their constituents. And Trump, you know, he's on his ego trip. He doesn't care, really, because he has no real constituents. Everything that he's done has been a manipulation, a farce, a exploitation. Everything he said, he's gone against.
Well, he was never a senator or a congressman or anything like
right,
that.
Right, and he just has these wayward business practices that he's been putting forth as politics, and because it served that spectrum of politics, the Republicans finally, you know, capitulated. They were going to support him, even though they didn't in the beginning. But ultimately, they're going to be the ones that are going to be losing their seats when, you know, the Rust Belt takes a second look and sees all these jobs again going to Mexico and to other countries. And in fact, the wall, I think I said before, is going to keep Americans out, because we're going to be wanting to go there for our jobs again. So I think people are going to wake up, and then ultimately, I think that they're going to have to pay a price for this. Even though there is this resurgence of racism, I think that there are a lot of people who voted for Trump because they really wanted that change that he was talking about, draining the swamp. It looks like we've got a call coming in, so speak for a minute. I'm going to pick up this and see who it is.
Okay. Yeah,
Hello?
I think that...
Hello?
I think one of the people that we've interviewed on the air who was Swanson, David Swanson, had mentioned that there, you know, that actually the people, for instance, and he was saying about Pennsylvania, that many of the people who voted for Trump this time around voted for Obama before, so the reasons for people voting is more complex, mm-hmm. and I think it's in line with what you're saying. It may be about, you know, promising change, not getting it, and then having someone else use the same language and hoping that, you know, that they actually mean what they say this time around. But I think one thing people don't realize is that it's very easy to use progressive sounding language. You just get a certain speechwriter and you're good. It's not so much about your words, it's about your deeds. And it's not so much about your skin color, it's about the quality of your policies and your character.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's something that I don't know how many people still think that it's all about the superficial things. Because no matter what you look like or your gender, if your policies affect the people here, as well as in other countries,
mm-hmm.
in ways that you may not even understand or imagine, it's really about your actions that matter. And we're talking about lives here. This is not...
Yeah, and I think it's also, I think people have to wake up to to even bigger issues, that it isn't even about Trump, in the sense that, you know, the system is so manipulated on such a grand scale where I'm not even sure that there are different countries. It looks like that's Russia. This looks like the American United States. But they all seem to be playing the same game, you know, manipulating for power and control and making boogeymen of each other to make people afraid to move in a direction that they're being pushed. So to me, it looks like a huge, huge game. And I believe we have to wake up to and find a way to address this beyond just the politic of it, because it's time for these wars to end, you know, the bombing and the exploitation and the killing because of resources in order to control poppy fields, or in order to control oil fields, or in order to control some gold, depending on the country. So Africa, they're pulling out the gold and the minerals. In the Middle East, they're pulling out the oils. And, in the United States and in America, they're pulling out the fracking oils. So it's all about exploitation. And humanity overall has to stop allowing this manipulation of our psyche. And we just have to expand and advance psychologically and emotionally beyond this manipulation.
Easier said than done.
It is, but that, I believe that's what's required.
Right, right. You know, I was looking yesterday online. It came up. An Israeli soldier's story, Iran Efrati, educateyourself.org. He tells his story in the Israeli army, what he experienced going into people's homes and just being ordered to shoot people. You know, these are civilians. And he says, what am I doing here? What am I doing? And people that, in another DVD, you see this fellow who was in Iraq who refused to reload his gun to shoot at innocent people, civilians. He went to jail for 8 months for that. You know, so these kind of policies, I don't know what to make of that. Alan Watts, if you listen to him, he's talking in the 50s, and his material is still so pertinent, you know, when you start to look at it from a spiritual perspective. It's still very pertinent. Another thing was a film I saw this weekend, Jean Renoir, La Règle du Jeu, The Rules of the Game. And this shows how the aristocracy, or the bourgeoisie, these people that are very well off, they don't work, so they get into these games, these emotional games, you know, with their wives and their mistresses, and you see all this stuff going on. And, you know, in certain respects, it goes on in another way in modern day. And it continues.
Yeah, except the games are played with huge populations and whole countries.
Right, that's true.
I remember the I remember the first Cold War. And in the mid-80s, when I was in my very early 20s, I had turned off the television for years, and I was pretty, conscious of being manipulated by the media, and so I intentionally kind of divorced myself from it, and I was able to travel when I was 22, and I had met people abroad, and they inspired me to travel. And so I was in the Soviet Union back in 1986, mm-hmm. 2 weeks after the Chernobyl explosion.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now that's brave.
Well, they didn't cancel the tour. The winds blew the other way. We were going to the south, which was Armenia, Azerbaijan, mm-hmm. Georgia. But I remember sitting in a hotel lobby. It must have been in Azerbaijan, right on the Caspian Sea. And I was watching a made-for-TV movie, Soviet style. And what really crystallized the way that media engineers your sense of reality is the same way we grew up with, you know, the dissonant music, you know, and out comes the Soviets. Well, they had the mirror image in the Soviet Union. You have the dissonant music and out comes the Americans. Yeah. And I remember watching this and I'm like, well, that's how they did it. That's how you have this clique that controls the media, that engineers your sense of reality, that paralyzes you, and they pit whole groups of people against each other just through this little light in the box. But it was just the absurdity of seeing the mirror image on a made-for-television movie in the Soviet Union. And I'll never, ever forget that. And it really, what you're saying about pitting people against each other totally artificially is very true.
I know. And then that's supplemented by the handiwork of the, the Secret Service class. You know, people going in and fomenting trouble between groups and events taking place and being blamed on the other group. Well, the bombing was the terrorists did that bombing. Meanwhile, it could just as easily have been the provocateurs of the same side who just wanted to create that dynamic. And, you know, a lot of these false flags do happen. And then I think the another part that we don't pay enough attention to is the class of people who sell out. You know, like, for instance, you could look at what's happening in Africa, what's happening in the Middle East. The leaders who have integrity very often are assassinated. And those people who are willing to sell out may be motivated by seeing the assassinations, but they'll sell themselves out, and they simply become the mechanism for the exploitation of their own people, you know. And then we have the other side of the coin of the so-called we're going to go in and help people and build dams and bridges and feed people, but what they do is they get these countries into enormous debt. So nobody's giving them anything. They're being caused to sign these agreements where they're actually taking loans to build these dams and bridges so that the country goes into debt. And so all the resources goes back to paying the debt. And so there's this systemic trap that's set that has been set for the so-called third world and for certain regions of the world that sets it up, the game is set up so that all the resources leave the country and the people of a very rich country are left in poverty. And then when, in order to really keep that, then that's when the terrorism and the wars come in and people are set against each other, and you'll see wholesale genocide, or you'll see the advent of terrorism. And all these things are in many ways manipulated as part of this system of control. And I really think the answer is that people just really have to wake up, like the soldier who wouldn't reload his gun. You know, people have to reach a level of consciousness where we will no longer do these things, even if you have to pay the price. I mean, if you decide under the current system, I'm done killing innocent people, 8 months in jail to me is not a big sacrifice. I'm not saying it's fair or it's right, but if you've really made that choice, but what would they do if every soldier did that?
What if there was a war and nobody came?
Yeah. I mean, and I think that as people really begin to wake up to what's happening, and it's like even in, you know, countries who might be said to be where the terrorists are. I believe terrorism is all manufactured. But, it's like people, need to be able to really to be able to stand up and live in their own countries, and, you know, that their children not be subjected to being seduced by these organizations. And so I think it's just that people have to be willing to stand up for the truth. And a lot of the religious organizations, such as anything that is so orthodox that there's not room for humanity, you know, it's not the religion, it's that there's no compassion in some of these states.
But I think that the religiosity is something that also is used to be a political tool.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely.
Because in many of these governments are secular. Mm-hmm. So the aim is to take over a secular government and then bring in an orthodox one. And that's how that's the pattern.
Because that's the pattern of control.
Yes.
Well, take some rabbi that I know, for instance. I don't know if I could get this person to watch Five Broken Cameras, that film that a Palestinian made. He was shooting while they were just breaking his house down and chasing people out, shooting people. He takes and he's just videoing this. And the soldiers see him and they break his camera. And they did it 5 times, hence the title of the movie. And this movie was nominated for an Oscar. You could probably watch it online. It's one of our premiums. You know, I'm sorry.
It's all right. We're going to be fundraising in February. Maybe we should bring that one out.
Also, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, sure, by John Perkins.
Sure.
You know, he just tells what we did to Allende, for instance.
And to Trujillo in Panama. Torrijos in Panama.
Think of his daughter. She's Isabel Allende. She's an author. She's written several books.
Sure.
And it also brings to mind another one of our premiums, sorry, The Great Lies of History. These are films by Massimo Mazzucco. One of them was The Project for New American Century. And in that, they show this supposedly young girl who was a nurse. And she says, and they took the babies in the freeze. She was coached by a public relations firm,
yeah,
and to convince people to go to war.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just boggles the mind. You know, this is
one book that I thought was very interesting at the time was Phyllis Bennis's book on the UN. I forget the name of it, unfortunately, but it was published in the early 90s, and she really talked through the whole process of for instance, with the first bombing of Iraq, the, you know, April Glaspie, this diplomat telling Saddam Hussein, you know, you can do what you want to do, you have no problem with us. Mm-hmm. And so he sort of fell right into the trap. So there are all of these things that happen that are not, you know, that are documented, for instance, in the John Perkins book, in the Phyllis Bennis book, and of course was documented by Robert Knight, mm-hmm, that are part of the background. And in terms of Africa, the continent, one of the things that I think is striking is how trade and policy are linked.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton, under his administration, created a law or signed into law something called the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And what it did is that it granted special trade relationships with countries in exchange for their support for anything this government does. And what I did at the time was get the actual legislation and read through it. And so basically each country had to sort of go through certain steps to get into sort of this sort of realm of being favored. But once you got that realm, they said basically you have to vote along whatever lines we tell you to, which means diplomatic voting in any of these agencies. So trade and foreign policy are related. The question of, you know, why certain governments do things, it's because of those kinds of documents. where they spell it out in plain English. You know, mm-hmm. you have to be loyal to the security interests of a given country if you want this to happen. We'll create this infrastructure for you. In exchange for this. So all of these behaviors are not really illogical. They're very logical.
And that's really why these trade treaties are so dangerous, because there's so much in them that it's not just about trading apples for oranges. It's really about domination and control and exploitation of resources, and also exploitation of human resources in terms of the energy of people's labor, the energy of their what should be theirs, because the resources of the land really belong to the people, and we're in a system that really must be deconstructed.
Well,
the whole system has to be deconstructed eventually.
Well, these trade agreements, you have the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. They're not free. And now you have the TPP, which is NAFTA on steroids. And this, Ken Gale was talking about this. He did some very good shows on this, by the way. He was talking about this document. It weighs 30 pounds or something like that. Thousands of pages. Who's going to read everything to evaluate?
You know? I'd read it if I could get a copy.
And they wanted to fast track it. I don't know actually what the status of this document is. Did it? It was waiting for Obama's John Hancock, as it were. I don't know what happened with that, actually. I have to ask Ken about that. He would know. We do have a documentary that he did at the Murphy Institute, a backroom deal for the 1%, the Trans-Pacific Partnerships. Sorry, another premium.
Don't apologize. It is what it is.
Yeah. But this is why, you know, the importance of WBAI. This is amazing, the education that you get here. I work with these things almost every day, and I do watch them. You know, more people should see these things. You really need this education.
Well, that's a good thing, and I hope that we can find a way for people to get access to a lot of this stuff. I think it would be wonderful if, because a lot of the things that producers create are very, very good and very, very valuable, but not everybody knows about it because the producer might be in some obscure time slot. I would love to see all this stuff just be made available on a regular basis so that people could just either listen to it or, get a copy of it, just like you would any other music on iTunes or whatever. I think we should do that. It would make much more sense. But then life doesn't always make sense. We have a call-in line if anyone wants to join this discussion, has some thought about the age of in between. It's 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. You can call in with your comments. I'm going to play a little music and see. We're going to do Rolling Stone, Sympathy for the Devil. Stay tuned.
Now you masters of war.
Okay, so we played the wrong song. That's Odetta sings Dylan,
you
Masters of War.
All of the guns. You that build the dead plane. You that build the big bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind the desk, just want you to know that I see through your mask. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like the Judas of old.
Hello, you're on the air. You wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, I want to make a comment that you're discussing a lot of different narratives. You and your co-hosts are discussing a lot of different narratives.
Yes.
There is something to be said about the parasites, or I would say the parasitic nature of certain elements of our society that has...
Is your radio on?
No, hold on.
Okay, we're getting a little feedback.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better. Go ahead.
So, there...
The gentleman said something very quickly that,
what can I say? It seems to be high fashion to lie at a Senate confirmation hearing with high platitudes and obfuscation, as we just witnessed with this woman who apparently wants to be, you know, the czar of the educational system. And I think it's a good representation of parasites coming full fold. Accumulating and cultivating this mentality and this toxic, almost demonic and schizophrenic human behavior pattern for the past 100 years, or if not 140 years, but it's been cultivated and been on like a high, full-blast, high-octane roller coaster since, like the gentleman said, or the woman said, 25 years since the 1980s, or I would even go back to the assassination of JFK and, of course, 1972 with Nixon. But this behavior pattern is quite schizophrenic. It's quite not sane, and it needs to be called out on it. You talked about you and your co-host made so many different, I would call them parallel narratives that have brought us to this very interesting times, as you coined it. I would have to say that it's also an influx for a great deal of possibilities to our advantage.
I agree.
And as long as we have dissension, as long as we have a white, fake, neoliberal hierarchy in the establishment of so-called liberals and progressives, there'll be no change, because the complicity is there. The status quo is there. The discrimination of people of color, particularly of black men, is there. The scrutiny, and highly scrutinizing in the double standards, it lies there. It's reflective, and the yoke of it is even affecting this great radio station as well.
Mm-hmm. I agree, actually.
Thank you.
I totally agree with what you're saying.
Now, I can get into details about who's this and name names. But it's not necessary.
Yeah, no, we don't need to go into that. I don't think we have enough time for that. But
I'm sorry. Not about the radio station, but names on our national level and on the behavior patterns of those who are attempting to take over the reins of decision-making authority in the executive branch. I mean, it's totally a circus.
Yeah,
it's a big circus.
And I think a lot of what you're saying is self-evident. You know, we as citizens can see this, but, you know, the game is in play. And in a way, this is why I've been feeling that it really requires a higher level of consciousness and awareness on behalf of each of us to see very clearly what's happening in order to have a strategy to pull it apart. So do you have any thoughts about how to politically make this change?
Oh, yeah, it's quite easy to say it and verbalize it. But that's the first thing you do, other than conceptualizing in thought.
Mm-hmm.
But to verbalize it and place it into the universe is the most profound thing you can do, is just simply verbally declare that this will not be so. This will not be so. And have remedies and different strategies to rectify it.
Mm-hmm.
One being would be reevaluate and have a deep reflection on oneself, individually level, as far as escaping to what is out there in the tabloids or escaping to what's out there in the toxic, 3-4 corners of your universe, in terms of your job, your religion, your friends, your education system, and just reflect upon yourself first. Look in the mirror and see, do you want a duality of good versus evil, carnivore, barbaric behavior, couched as the Republican or neoconservative parties, double standards in our law enforcement system, double standards on people on the way they look, high scrutiny for those who are feeling, you know, who are lesser than. Look in the mirror. What is your self-worth? And see that, are you overprivileged? Are you seriously thinking that you have some sense of entitlement, that you can empower your decisions and your opinions and your aggressiveness on someone else, and take that into the global and international arenas? Why are these big countries, United States, Russia, China, always, you know, aggressively imposing themselves on weaker countries? You know, taking their resources, like you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. you know, to taking their only their bloodlines and their birthrights. And they're like African Americans who have been here, their estates and their estates, their identity and their bloodline, and their trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is all accumulating parallel narratives that accumulate to this precipice, and this is the precipice we're going through, as the gentleman discussed. In you know, these countries in the Middle East, Israel is a deep factor. It's not the only factor, and they should not be scapegoated for being Zionist or overzealous, but it's a serious factor. And
well,
we have...
That's
we,
not
and
a
I would
scapegoat.
Have to say, I would have to say this, and I'll leave you with this. Mm. It seems like there's a graphic novel taking place, if you can hear me out, where the three or the four major religions have culminated into this friction or confrontation in the graphic novels of the Torah, the Bible, and Islam, the Quran, seems to be trumpeting in a Donald Trump in the Book of Revelations with this not so very forgiving, dubious wife on top of the animal in that graphic novel of Revelations. If you catch my drift. If
yeah, so it's like the manipulation is to bring forth that which has been prophesied, but of
yes.
course even the prophecy is a lie.
Thank you very much. You got it. Now,
I appreciate Eric, what you're saying. Yeah.
And Eric Prince, he is a babbling baby who thinks he's a macho man, and he has to go, and the whole team has to go.
Very, very interesting, yeah.
All right, you have a good time.
Thank you. What is your name?
My name is Tide.
Tide. Well, thank you for your call.
Peace.
Mm-hmm. All right, that was interesting, and I could kind of get that. You wanted to say something, Matt?
Yeah. And what I was saying about Israel and Palestine, they are not scapegoats. These are real things that are happening. A scapegoat, as I understand it, is someone that you single out. You make a fall guy out of him.
But I think you're right. I think how I would interpret all this is that what happens is that we're seeing a political aggression being codified, and if anyone has anything to say about it, then it becomes, oh, you're anti-Jewish or anti-Zionist. And it's really not about the religion at all. It's about the behavior that people are engaging in. It's about it's the same domination that took place in America when the Europeans first came here and grabbed the land from the indigenous people that were here. And so it's the from my perspective, this whole issue of scapegoat is if to say it's like hiding behind cry of racism or hiding behind the cry of anti-Semitism and not allowing an examination of the behavior, which from my perspective really doesn't have anything to do with religion. Before Israel became a state, there was not this conflict between Palestinian people and Jewish people. They lived in the same region, and I think it would still be much less conflict if not for the push for power, control, property rights. I mean, all of this. And so it's very, very complicated.
Well, as for the Bible, though, you know, I don't pretend to be any scholar, but I'm getting a different perspective on it. The stories that they tell, they're not literal. You can't take them literally, and you have to sort of read between the lines and get the true meaning, what the true message is. And very interesting book, Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. He talks about his dialogue with his guru, and there are footnotes where he explains certain things about the Bible and certain sections of it. It's a very interesting read. It'll give you a different perspective.
I think it's not really so. We have another call coming. It's not so much the books, but how it's been used and interpreted by the clergy.
Absolutely.
As a mechanism of control, and
right,
so there
right.
may be truth in it, but generally speaking, that truth is not realized in the practice. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to give some historical perspective on what we've been discussing. I recommend to everybody that I talk to three books that I think are important. Mm-hmm. Jim Marr's book, Crossfire, about the conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. JFK, Oliver Stone's movie, is based on that, the core group of people that were behind that and the organizations behind the murder of President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Dr. King and Patrice Lumumba, President of Congo. Then The Secret War Against the Jews, which was Pulitzer Prize-winning book for history, talks about David Rockefeller, Bush Sr.'s father and grandfather, and Allen and John Dulles and the Third Reich from the 20s on. Which now obviously we see in Breitbart and Bannon. It's just a continuation of the same white supremacy GOP party that started in 21 with the Dulles brothers and David Rockefeller and the Council of Foreign Relations. The third book is David Talbot's Devil's Chessboard, which is specifically the biography of Allen Dulles. What he did, what he and John Foster Dulles did before, during, and after the war for Sullivan and Cromwell, and then for Eisenhower and Nixon, and Allen Dulles handpicked Nixon and Reagan from the 50s on. So that's the continuity, again, of the white supremacy GOP. But to give blame where blame is due, George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush's third business partner, that owns Silesian Steel Corporation, using Auschwitz death camp labor during the war to make Nazis steal was Democrat Avril Harriman. Also to give blame where blame is due, according to Crossfire, Johnson was intimately and integrally involved in the conspiracy to kill Kennedy and the cover-up, putting Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission to cover the crime that he had called. So this is the information I give out to everybody that I talk to, that this is a long, continuous story that that with Lynn Cheney writing the history book for U.S. public schools with the Heritage Foundation, of course they're not going to name the GOP Nazi white supremacy as their own. And as we're seeing with DeVos, and her Christian fascism and her agenda with Prinz, since they're brother and sister. And then the, do you remember with Bush talking about the destruction of the EPA calling it the Blue Skies Initiative? It was that upside down thinking, talking. Well, that's exactly what we're seeing again with this administration, is that if you question their sanity, they make us the insane.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I think what the other gentleman was saying along with Perkins, who I've heard on WBAI, is that this is systematic, it's planetary, it's transnational, and obviously the agenda is for the benefit of the one half of 1% and keeping people fighting for the little, as the president said, for the scraps, while they have it all.
Yeah.
So it is systematic, and it's criminally insane. The corporate structure rewards the most venomous, immoral, criminally insane among us. And then as we're hearing, you know, these people that weren't put in jail for the destruction in 2008 are now back again because they weren't taken to task.
Yeah.
And now they're being rewarded, just as Trump is being rewarded for being, you know, what he is. But I would agree with you that I heard Robert Thurman talking about the best we can do is to pray for the happiness of the adversary as a way to get to the place of loving our enemy, is that we wish for our adversary the same happiness we wish for ourselves, as a way to get peace inside and outside. And of course, it's incredibly difficult because we want to go, well, you're the devil, you're the evil, you're the, you know, whatever.
But I agree with you. And it's a really important principle of understanding how energy works. One of the reasons that this system has become so powerful, it's because it's translated the psychology of humanity into a state of being fearful,
right.
And all, fearful it's of all, each other.
Exactly,
and,
it's all fear-based.
And it's in that fear and competition with each other,
right,
that fuels the power of the elite. You know, that's what they use. We become weapons against each other.
Exactly.
And move along the chessboard while the ones in power sit back and gather all the spoils. But right. If we as a citizenry can take back that power, and this is where the love is really comes in, it's because when you're not in that state of hatred, then
fear.
we can begin to look at each other with a comprehension that we are equal and divine and have
right.
all these wonderful qualities.
Right.
And we can stop killing each other on behalf of this small elite. And it really does take that level of
consciousness. I always like to add that the ruling elite don't believe in the karmic law of living love, which is what you put out there, you get back. They don't believe in reincarnation. And they don't believe in the cosmic law that love always wins and that fear always loses. And that's the only planetary cosmic level that we are here to learn, that despite what seems to be time on our planet, which is the only place that time is, that in the eternity of the cosmos, love always wins.
Even if it takes 250,000 years.
That's correct.
I totally agree. And I think that's where you know, the system got very lazy, thinking that this wouldn't come to an end. But it will.
Well, it's always the attachment to the material and the empire's glorification, every empire's glorification of the material over the divine spirit, which is in all of us. And, you know, it's taken me a long time to get past my rage and because the outrage of seeing Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, President Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Dr. King, Patrice Lumumba, John Lennon,
it's too many to even mention, isn't it?
Peter Tosh, Bob Marley, President Benson Guatemala taken out in the 50s, the Prime Minister Mossadegh put in, taken out, and that's all the Dulles brothers. And backing the Shah of Iran. That was Alan and John Dulles set Kennedy up for Cuba Bay of Pigs. But all of that is in those three books.
Wow.
I heard Oliver Stone speaking on WBAI because he was talking about Crossfire. And he said that he had the hardest time getting any approval from the major corporate press, but you know, they all downed him. They all downed his movie as this, you know, conspiracy theory. You know what a nutcase. When actually, he really put it out there. I also read Jim Garrison's On the Trail of Assassins, which was his autobiography, and also Pruti. I'm just starting to read Pruti, which Oliver Stone recommends as well.
Well, two of these things are premiums, actually. We have The Devil's Chessboard that
Excellent.
Was done by Amy Goodman. And we do have Guns and Butter, Bonnie Faulkner, on at 9 a.m. on Wednesday mornings. She did the Garrison interview. She interviews him.
Right. That's where I heard it.
So,
and
we have that.
That's why I recommend Crossfire by Jim Mars and The Secret War Against the Jews. I talked to John Loftus down in Florida. He's in St. Petersburg at the Holocaust Museum. And I said, in your book, you said that you thought that the conversations between the American Nazis and the German Nazis that Roosevelt was taping, that he was going to use for the treason trials of Rockefeller, Bush, and Dulles at Nuremberg, you said you thought that they were at Fort Meade. And I said, well, where are they? And he said, good news is 2020, they're released to the public, which is the conversations during the war between David Rockefeller, George Herbert Walker, Prescott Bush, Abel Harriman, and John and Alan Dulles, and the Nazis in their own voices will be released to the public.
Well, we'll have to get hold of those. Well, you know, I really, really appreciate your call. We have a segment coming up. What is your name?
My name's Jesse.
Jesse. Well, thank you so much for calling, Jesse.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
Tell the babies we're here. No fear.
Okay. Sounds great.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
By the way, I was listening to a speech by Martin Luther King yesterday. Another premium. This was Mimi Rosenberg's King's Labor Speeches. It's on that. Martin Luther King's talking about love. He's describing three different types of love. And he talks about your enemies. You may not agree with you doing. I'm paraphrasing. You have to hear. It's amazing, his explanation, his definition. You have to hear that.
I know there's such a rich legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as well as many of these great change makers that have come and gone, but we don't get to hear the richness of what they shared. You know, we get to hear a few sound bites, except, of course, on WBAI. We go into it. So I'm going to go and see if I can find and play the right song this time. Well, not that the other was wrong, but Rolling Stone, Sympathy for the Devil. I like this song. And then we're going to go to our serial reading of Ishmael with Matt Mazza. So please do stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
Myself, I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his fate. Meet you, hope you guess my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuffing around St. Petersburg when I saw it was a time for change. Killed the Tsar and his ministers. Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank, held a generous rank. When the bliss free rage and the body stank. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. Oh yeah. I was puzzling you.
The next episode of Ishmael with Matt Mazza.
Ishmael, this is by Daniel Quinn, and also the website is ishmael.org. If you want to communicate with other people that are reading this, and we finished last time where they were discussing you increase the food supply, you will increase the population. So this is, what do you do with the starving people? How do you not violate this law? What is the law? Well, you cross into Hopi territory, for instance. You were not given a form to fill out. They killed you. That worked very well. That gave people a powerful incentive to limit their growth. So if you stay in one territory and you can't go outside, then you would limit your growth. So we finish here. So they limited each other. But not just by erecting uncrossable territorial boundaries. Their cultural boundaries had to be uncrossed too. The excess population of the Narragansett couldn't just pack up and move out west to Cheyenne. The Narragansett had to stay where they were and limit their population. So it's another case where diversity seems to work better than homogeneity. And now we come to subsection 8. And this is...
Before you go on, do you mind if I comment a little on what you just said?
Surely.
That was last week. Mm-hmm. And I remember last week I was commenting, I don't get this analogy. And now that I'm actually not as exhausted as I was, I understand why I don't get it. I think that there's, you know, this using the indigenous population as an example of if you cross over into Hopi territory, you'll get killed. I don't buy into that.
Okay.
I'm not buying into the analysis that's being used in that book. That's all I'm saying. And that, for me, is what the disconnect is. So knowing a little bit about the Hopi, it's especially not true of them. So I think that... you know, that's just a quirk of the author, perhaps, but I have issues with that particular analogy, saying that, well, you limit your population because if you move into the other territory, you'll be killed. Somehow it doesn't sync with me because I'm looking at the colonizers and European population moving into the territories and killing the indigenous people. So I just had to put that out there. I couldn't. Sorry for the interruption. But
I understand.
I don't
that.
Think it's relevant to the point, but I just felt the need to respond to that.
Well, you know, also I'm reflecting on this. You know, he's saying that, you know, if you don't do anything, the population will just starve and will rebalance itself. Kind of. This is what I'm getting from this. You know, if you increase the food supply. You know, I think we already have enough to feed the populace three times over. It's just that somehow it never gets.
Yeah, and I think that's why I'm starting. I'm feeling a shift in the narrative of this book.
I understand that.
You know, I'm feeling a shift where it was, first it was about revealing, and now it's about cloaking. But okay. I mean, that's just what's coming up for me. Let's hear the narrative.
Okay, so we're on, this is chapter 8, subsection 8. A week ago, Ishmael said, when we were talking about laws, you said that there's only one kind of law about how people should live, the kind that can be changed by a vote. What do you think now? Can the laws that govern competition in the community be changed by a vote? No. But they're not absolutes, like the laws of aerodynamics. They can be broken. Can't the laws of aerodynamics be broken? No. If your plane isn't built according to the law, it doesn't fly. But if you push it up a cliff, it stays in the air, doesn't it? For a while. The same is true of a civilization that isn't built in accordance with the law of limited competition. It stays in the air for a while, and then it comes down with a crash. Isn't that what the people of your culture are facing here? A crash? Yes. You know, as a side comment, the way we live, I mean, we print money out of thin air. So we devalue the currency that way. They call it qualitative easing. You or I do it, we go to jail. So this is interesting. And according, I heard somewhere that a bumblebee, according to the laws of aerodynamics, I guess its body weight and its shape, according to laws of aerodynamics, it should not be able to fly. But it does. So this is an interesting point. So to continue, I'll ask the question another way. Are you certain that any species that, as a matter of policy, exempts itself from the law of limited competition will end by destroying the community to support its own expansion? Yes. Then what have we discovered here? We've discovered a piece of certain knowledge about how people ought to live, must live, in fact. Knowledge that a week ago you said was unobtainable. Yes, but... Yes? I don't see how. Hold on for a minute. Take your time. I don't see how to make this a source of knowledge in general. I mean, I don't see any way to apply this knowledge in a general way to other issues. Do the laws of aerodynamics show you how to repair damaged genes? No. Then what good are they? They're good for... They enable us to fly. The law we've outlined here enables species to live, enables species to survive, including the human. It won't tell you whether mood-altering drugs should be legalized or not. It won't tell you whether premarital sex is good or bad. It won't tell you whether capital punishment is right or wrong. It will tell you how you have to live if you want to avoid extinction. And that's the first and most fundamental knowledge anyone needs. True. All the same, yes. All the same, the people of my culture will not accept it. You mean the people of your culture will not accept what you've learned here? That's right. Let's be clear about what they will and will not accept. The law itself is beyond argument. It's there plainly in place in the community of life. What the takers will deny is that it applies to mankind. That's right. That hardly comes as a surprise. Mother culture could accept the fact that mankind's home is not the center of the universe. She could accept the fact that man evolved from the common slime. But she will never accept the fact that man is not exempt from the peacekeeping law of the community of life. To accept that would finish her off. So what are you saying? That it's hopeless? Not at all. Obviously, mother culture must be finished off if you're going to survive, and that's something the people of your culture can do. She has no existence outside your minds. Once you stop listening to her, she ceases to exist. True, but I don't think people will let that happen. Ishmael shrugged. Then the law will do it for them. If they refuse to live under the law, then they simply won't live. You might say this is one of the law's basic operations. Those who threaten the stability of the community by defying the law automatically eliminate themselves. The takers will never accept that. Acceptance has nothing to do with it. You may as well talk about a man stepping off the edge of a cliff, not accepting the effects of gravity. The takers are in the process of eliminating themselves, and when they've done so, the stability of the community will be restored and the damage you've done can begin to be repaired. True. On the other hand, I think you're being unreasonably pessimistic about this. I think there are a lot of people out there who know the jig is up and are ready to hear something new, who want to hear something new, just like you. I hope you're right. Subsection 9. I'm not quite satisfied with the way we've formulated this law, I said. No. We refer to it as a law, but it's actually three laws, or at any rate, I described it as three laws. The three laws are branches. What you're looking at for is the trunk, which is something like, no one species shall make the life of the world its own. Yes, that's what the rules of competition ensure. That's one expression of the law. Here's another. The world was not made for any one species. Yes, then man was certainly not made to conquer and rule it. That's too big a leap. Taker mythology, the world needed a ruler because the gods had made a mess of it. What they'd created was a jungle, a howling chaos, an anarchy. But was it that in fact? No, everything was in good order. It was the takers who introduced disorder into the world. The rule of that law was, and is, sufficient. Mankind was not needed to bring order to the world. Subsection 10. The people of your culture cling with fanatical tenacity to the specialness of man. They want desperately to perceive a vast gulf between man and the rest of creation. This mythology of human superiority justifies their doing whatever they please with the world, just the way Hitler's mythology of Aryan superiority justified his doing whatever he pleased with Europe. But in the end, this mythology is not deeply satisfying. The takers are a profoundly lonely people. The world for them is enemy territory, and they live in it like an army of occupation, alienated and isolated by their extraordinary specialness. That's true, but what are you getting at? Instead of answering my question, Ishmael said, among the levers, crime, mental illness, suicide, and drug addiction are great rarities. How does Mother Culture account for this? I'd say it's because Mother Culture says it's because the levers are just too primitive to have these things. In other words, crime, mental illness, suicide, and drugs, addictions, are features of an advanced culture. That's right. Nobody says it that way, of course, but that's how it's understood. These things are the price of advancement. There's an almost opposite opinion that has had wide currency in your culture for a century or so. An opposite opinion as to why these things are rare among the levers. I thought for a minute. You mean the noble savage theory? I can't say I know it in any detail. But you have an impression of it. That's what's current in your culture, not the theory in detail, but an impression of it. True. It's the idea that people living close to nature tend to be noble. It's seeing all those sunsets that does it. You can't watch a sunset and then go off and set fire to your neighbor's teepee. Living close to nature is wonderful for your mental health. You understand that I'm not saying anything like this. Yes, but what are you saying? We've had a look at the story the takers have been enacting here for the past 10,000 years. The leavers, too, are enacting a story, not a story told, but a story enacted. What do you mean by that? If you go among the various peoples of your culture, if you go to China and Japan and Russia and England and India, each people will give you a completely different account of themselves. But they are nonetheless all enacting a single basic story, which is the story of the takers. The same is true of the leavers, the Bushmen of Africa, the Alawa of Australia, the Cree Akori of Brazil, and the Navajo of the United States would each give you a different account of themselves, but they too are all enacting one basic story, which is the story of the leavers. I see what you're getting at. It isn't the tale you tell that counts, it's the way you actually live. That's correct. The story the takers have been acting here for the past 10,000 years is not only disastrous for mankind and for the world, it's fundamentally unhealthy and unsatisfying. It's a megalomaniac's fantasy, and enacting it has given the takers a culture riddled with greed, cruelty, mental illness, crime, and drug addiction. Yes, that seems to be so. The story the leavers have been enacting here for the past 3 million years isn't a story of conquest and rule. Enacting it doesn't give them power. Enacting it gives them lives that are satisfying and meaningful to them. This is what you'll find if you go among them. They're not seething with discontent and rebellion, not incessantly wrangling over what should be allowed and what forbidden, not forever accusing each other of not living the right way, not living in terror of each other, not going crazy because their lives seem empty and pointless, not having to stupefy themselves with drugs to get through the days, not inventing a new religion every week to give them something to hold on to, not forever searching for something to do or something to believe in that will make their lives worth living. And I repeat, this is not because they live close to nature or have no formal government or because they're innately noble. This is simply because they're enacting a story that works well for people, a story that worked well for 3 million years and that still works well where the takers haven't yet managed to stamp it out. Okay, that sounds terrific. When do we get to that story? Tomorrow. At least we'll begin tomorrow. Good, I said. Before we quit today, I have a question. Why Mother Culture? I personally have no difficulty with it, but I can imagine some women would, on the grounds that you seem to be singling out a figure of specifically female gender to serve as a cultural villain. Ishmael grunted. I don't consider her a villain in any sense whatever, but I understand what you're getting at. Here's my answer. Culture is a mother everywhere and at every time, because culture is inherently a nurturer, the nurturer of human societies and lifestyles. Among Leaver peoples, mother culture explains and preserves a lifestyle that is healthy and self-sustaining. among Taker peoples. This, she explains, and preserves a lifestyle that has proven to be unhealthy and self-destructive. Okay, so?
And we're out of time.
So what's your question? If a culture is a mother among the Alawa of Australia, then the Bushmen of Africa and the Kayapo of Brazil, then why wouldn't she be a mother among the Takers? End of chapter 8.
Beautiful. So time to go. Thank you all for being with us today. Thank you, Paulette.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you. Say that again.
Thank you, Catherine.
There you are. And thank you, Matt.
You're very welcome.
And I want to thank our callers. We had some really thoughtful callers today. And I want to thank all of you who've been tuning in. We're going to head for some music as we head for the door. I'm playing, starting off with Sarah McLachlan, Dear God, from Rarities, B-Sides, and Other Stuff. Then Stevie Wonder, Have a Talk with God, and Michelle Indiocello, God Shiva. Of course, we don't have time for all that, but that's the lineup. What did Obama do that is abominable? We saw something. I saw a paper there.
He officially denied clemency to Leonard Peltier.
Leonard Peltier.
Wow.
Leonard Peltier officially denied clemency by Obama. And the Native American activist lawyer said not granting clemency was like a death sentence given Peltier's poor health. It's not a happy thing. I mean, I heard he gave Chelsea Manning a break. I don't see why
he did.
All right, so we're going to hear this song, and we're going to make room for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. So please do stay tuned.
Down here, I don't need a big reduction in the price of beer. And all the people that you made in your image, see them starving on their feet, 'cause they don't get enough to eat. Oh God,
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name's Jim Freund. With us shortly via Skype will be Terrence Taylor, reading, talking about his books, and then he and I will branch out into, well, mystery. Stay tuned. Terrence Taylor will be our guest. However, I am going to begin with a recorded reading that he made of one of his segment from one of his novels, Bite Marks, which will then give me the opportunity to attempt to get him online through Skype so that we can talk together together with a certain amount of clarity. So, without much further ado, we don't have a review this week, by the way, from Dan Persons. Hopefully a catch-up next week. But believe me, Terrence and I will probably get into some issues about media, especially since he and I went to see Star Wars, the latest edition, last Monday, yeah, it was a holiday week, so only a couple of days ago, and we had very interesting, we saw the same movie, we perceived it the same way, but we had very different emotional reactions, which I find very interesting. We're going to explore that, but not until he's talked about his writing, so let's listen to him read some of his writing.
My first novel, Bite Marks, was a wonderful journey. There are several vampires in it of various backgrounds, and it's trying to be subtle, but... Ah, thank you. but one of my favorites was Ramon. Ramon is a 1,000-year-old Moorish vampire, and I, at this point, don't actually remember what inspired his birth, as it were, but... He gave me an origin point to both vampirism, but also many other things. So this chapter is essentially his origin story. This is midway through the book, but this is his memory of how he became a vampire. Excuse me. 1:33 p.m., Mauritania, Ifrica, 6th of September, 705 A.D. The sun seared his vision as Rahman stumbled behind Da'ia al-Kaina's horse. Wrists bound in front of him, walked for what seemed miles. The desert was even more desolate than the mountains where they had been hiding for almost a month. Da'ia was the leader of a rebellion in the mountains of Ifrica, the Berber name for North Africa. For 5 years, competing tribes united under her command had successfully fought off the Arabic spread of Islam. She was tall, dark brown, her hair a wild mane of black and gray dreadlocks, beautiful in an untamed, savage way. Da'ia had captured Rahman in battle a week earlier. He was a Muslim scientist and officer in an army fighting not for gain, but for Allah, to spread his worship across an ever-expanding empire. There had been resistance, as expected. His legion and others were sent to reclaim land lost to the Byzantines and cut off any chance for them to still the growing Muslim winds of change. What they found, instead of organized resistance, were scattered pockets of Berber tribesmen, fiercely independent, tough, used to fighting nature and one another to survive. Dahiya had brought them together against a common enemy. While they could be dismissed individually, united they were winning. They appeared from nowhere like animals to take what they needed, disappeared as quickly back into deserts and mountains. Rahman had warned his superiors of the hazards of war with such an enemy. They knew the land, fought from hiding, picked off his troops and wore them down like water eroding stone. Rahman was ordered to press forward. Their cause was more than just. It was holy. His was the most successful of the regiments dispersed. They massacred hundreds, made the tribes pay dearly for their opposition. The tide turned over time. For everyone they killed, two came back until they were slowly overwhelmed. In the end, Rahman had been forced to surrender, his remaining men weak from hunger and thirst. Dahiya rode into their midst like a winged avenger on horseback. "I only need one," she said, looked them over, and pointed to Rahman. "Take him. Kill the rest." Rahman protested. He'd surrendered only to save his men's lives, but he was beaten unconscious, heard their dying screams as he was carried into the Oris Mountains to Dahiya's headquarters. He'd been treated with respect, fed, and given shelter. He didn't understand why. Dahiya spoke with him often as he healed. They exchanged philosophies, politics. At first he thought she wanted military strategies, his nation's plans to defeat them, but she never asked that. Instead, they talked about family, honor, their dreams, what they had wanted their lives to be before they'd arrived here as soldiers on opposite sides of a great war. She spoke to him as an equal, but it was always clear what they really were, captor and captive. Though he was held hostage, time had passed quickly as Dahiya's troops came and went, reported to her how the war fared. Then today, their routine had changed. She sent her sons out on a secret mission and left soon after they did, took Rahman with her to the desert, his arms bound. They didn't stop until they reached the ancient well she called the Bir al-Attar, or the Well of Perfume, dark stone covered with ornate hieroglyphics he couldn't recognize or decipher, in an oasis he'd never seen before. Dahiya prayed for 3 days, to whom or what Rahman didn't know. At the end, a cauldron of herbs she'd mixed and simmered as she chanted was poured into a bowl. She drank half and fed him the rest. Rahman hadn't eaten any more than she had in the last 3 days, and despite himself, drank it down greedily. As he finished, she spoke. "Like me, you're more than a soldier. I'm a mother, a teacher. You're a scientist, a man of learning. You said you always wanted more time, Rahman, to explore, to study. I give you all the time you want, though it will not seem a gift at first." She smiled, stood, and stared down into the well. "The war's over for me. My sons are arranging the terms of a truce now with your Muslim commander to save the tribes who followed me. But there must still be a price for your people to pay if they don't honor the peace." She looked up at Rahman, her face filled with something that looked like a kind of love. "I've enjoyed our time together. You're a man of strength and honor. You've taught me much. I hope I've been your teacher as well. In another world, we might have been comrades, even lovers. But in this world, it ends." Dahiya pulled a sharp dagger from her waistband and tossed it to him so he could cut his bonds. Rahman caught the knife just as Dahiya leaned forward and threw herself into the well. He leaped to the edge, looked down into darkness. There was no sound when she hit bottom. However deep the well was, only the sounds of the desert. He'd never felt so alone. It was as if he'd always stood there by himself. When it was clear that she was gone for good, Rahman cut himself free, took Dahiya's horse, and made his escape. He didn't know what else to do. Rahman reached the camp of Hassan ibn al-Numan, his Muslim commander, before nightfall. He welcomed Rahman and confirmed that he'd worked out the terms of a peace with Dahiya's sons. They rested in a tent nearby. The treaty was already on its way back to the capital. It seemed the war was over. Then a horseman rode in with a report of a distant battle. Islamic troops had located a rebel encampment, and when they entered, a fight had ensued. The rebels had been killed, all the men, women, and even the children. Their encampment burned to the ground as an example. The Muslim commander ordered men back to secure what remained and informed the soldiers to cease further fighting, but the damage was done. On the day of the treaty, the empire had brutally crushed one of Dahia's allies. Rahman developed a fever that night, one that couldn't be quenched. He felt as if he would die, and he did, but felt himself wake again before dawn, ravenous. Rahman smelled food all around him, intoxicating, until he realized it was the scent of living blood in the soldiers. Understanding didn't stop him. He lost control of his rational mind to hunger. Blood was all that could slake his bottomless thirst, and he took it, swept through the camp as Dahia's avenger, wiped out the entire battalion on his first feeding as they fought back in vain. When his blood hunger was satisfied, he instinctively hid from the sun as it rose over the sand and understood at last what she'd done, what he'd become. Her death at the Well of Perfume was no suicide, but a sacrifice to a god so ancient it had no name. He had become a murderous instrument of Dahia's justice, her peacekeeper. Thank you. The fun thing about working on these books was that I fell in love with research, and essentially everything about Dahia is true, except for the fact that she sacrificed herself to create a vampire, but everything else I had found. And I kept finding these amazing people and these astounding women through history who were doing these incredible things. So the joy in writing is that it not only takes your readers to worlds they've never been to, but it takes you as a writer to worlds you never imagined. And the great thing is you get to like live in them until you finish with the book, and then it's very sad when you have to leave, which is the thing I hadn't expected.
Alrighty, so that was Terrence Taylor reading. Ooh, when was that reading? Well, he's going to call in. I've been having Skype problems having to do with authentication and one thing after another. So we're texting each other, so he's going to call me. And we're going to do this by phone, and maybe I can get Skype working as we speak, but I wouldn't count on it. So I've sent him the phone number, and hopefully he will be calling shortly. Ah, that